The following is an encore presentation of the World Vision Report.
This is the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Waymire. It's an old truism that education is the way out of poverty. A math teacher in India proved that was true for himself. Now, he's trying to make it happen for others.
He's sort of a very, very mini Warren Buffett or Bill Gates, who after accumulating their wealth, has parted with certain part of the wealth for the common people.
And closer to home, a group of nuns shares its philosophy on how to improve the lives of the poor.
Those who have more has got to live with simplicity so that the excess of wealth they have can be shared with those who have nothing.
Plus, author and economist Dambisa Moyo says aid hurts Africa more than it helps. Is she right? We bring you both sides of the age-old debate. Around the World with the World Vision Report, I'm Peggy Waymire. This is the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Waymire. Every year, students in India vie for places at the nation's premier science universities. The colleges are known collectively as the Indian Institutes of Technology. Across the country, hundreds of thousands of students take the entrance exam. Only a tiny handful, about the top 2%, are accepted. One math teacher has had extraordinary success getting his students in, despite the fact that many of them come from extreme poverty. From the northern city of Patna, the World Vision Report's Peter Aronson has the story.
For India's best and brightest, an IIT diploma is a golden career ticket. So the competition to get in is understandably fierce. Parents often spend big bucks on special tutoring programs to prepare their kids for the entrance exam. But what can students do if their parents can't afford 3 square meals a day, let alone money for tutoring? That's where mathematician Anand Kumar comes in. Kumar teaches in an open-air classroom, complete with dirt floor and tin roof. About 100 students sit crammed tightly together on simple wooden benches. They range in age from about 18 to 20, and about a third of them are girls. They sit separately. When Kumar writes on the blackboard, the students in back are so far away, it's almost impossible to make out what he's writing. But they don't complain, because no one in this class is paying a single rupee for the one-year course. The class started 7 years ago, and Kumar decided it was time for his successful prep course company to give something back to the community.
In 2002, I started a special group for extremely poor students who can't afford even the basic necessities of life. I selected the 30 sharpest who were poor, but who had the guts and the passion for math and science.
He called them the Super 30. He put them up in a dorm, and his own mother cooked them 2 simple hot meals a day, more than some of them got at home. Freed of financial concerns, the boys dedicated themselves exclusively to their studies. And when exam time finally came, the Super 30 lived up to their name.
After a year of hard work, 18 of my students qualified for Institutes of Technology, and the other 12 made it into the National Institutes of Technology. So I got a full batch of 30 students into the best engineering colleges in India.
Kumar became an overnight celebrity and a local hero. Since that first class, more and more of his students have gotten into IIT. And last year,
all 30. So that's my Super 30.
Keshav Nandan, a quiet village boy who dreams of working for NASA, is in this year's Super 30 class. He heard about it when he was in 9th grade.
What makes Super 30 special is that there's no pressure on us to get into IIT. Mr. Anand only tells us to enjoy mathematics, and often he provides 10 or 12 solutions for a single equation, and it's real fun to study that way.
Kumar teaches 70 more students tuition-free, although they don't get room and board like the Super 30. Last year, about 70% of them got into IIT, and nothing could please their teacher more, because he also grew up poor. Kumar had to turn down a scholarship to Cambridge because there was no money for travel or accommodations. Instead, he stayed home.
My mother started making flatbreads to support the family, and I was taking them around and selling them. That's how we got 2 square meals a day.
Meanwhile, he continued his studies at the local university, where a prominent mathematician took him on as a kind of apprentice. Over the years, Kumar has grown prosperous, and his reputation has grown as well. Local economist Shaibal Gupta explains why the people of this city love him.
He is sort of a very, very mini Warren Buffett or Bill Gates, who after accumulating their wealth, has parted with certain part of the wealth for the common people.
But not everyone loves him. A few years ago, Kumar started getting death threats from some competitors. He calls them the coaching mafias. Police traced one of the calls to a known felon and warned Kumar not to leave his home. But he didn't want to let his students down. That day, an attacker came at him with a sickle.
One of the staff members came between the sickle and me, and he was seriously wounded. He was admitted in the hospital for months, fighting for life, and after that, the police gave me security.
Now, four machine gun-toting bodyguards and a Doberman guard this mathematician and his family 24/7. Undeterred, he says he hopes to expand the size of the Super 30 group in the coming years. One competing school, though, not to be outdone on the charity front, recently announced it's going to start a scholarship group of its own. It's calling it the Fortunate 40. For the World Vision Report, I'm Peter Aronson in Patna, India.
Half the world's population, nearly 3 billion people, live in poverty. Across the globe, organizations and individuals are working hard to help lift people out of poverty. For a few, this means embracing poverty themselves. From Montreal, Judith Ritter reports.
Except for the occasional singing from the chapel, it's extraordinarily quiet here at the Convent of the Franciscan Sisters of Mary, home to close to 90 nuns. This morning, about a dozen of them are having breakfast in the convent dining room.
This morning I'm having a banana and a cup of water. That's all I need.
Sister Florence Burros isn't the only one eating modestly. No stacks of pancakes here. Even a spoonful of peanut butter is an indulgence. These nuns are devoted to helping the poor. Most have spent their lives working in the developing world. The women here are retired or semi-retired after years of nursing in China, teaching to the children of rubber plantation workers in Malaysia, and in Myanmar, living in rat-infested straw huts. Like all nuns, these sisters have taken a vow of poverty. In this order, that means existing in solidarity with the poor, living like them.
To me, it means to be free, free of always craving.
That's Sister Kathleen Lapointe. She set up health projects for poor black South Africans during the time of apartheid.
You see, you can live with less, be happy with less, and the extra you would have, you're happy to share with others. That makes my day.
This is my bedroom. If it were only me, this chair I wouldn't have, this table either, and this desk either, because that's too much.
Sister Florence shows me her room. It contains a narrow bed, a bureau, and a 50s-era wooden chair with a seat cushion. She thinks the cushion is unnecessary. She opens her small closet to show me a rather spare wardrobe.
My skirts? I have some since 1965. This gray pleated skirt was made in France, and I've had it since. I might wear it in my coffin.
Most of these women first learned about service to the poor as children from their parents. But the inspiration to lead a life of complete sacrifice came from a higher source.
It was as if God had placed this desire to go to the poorest and do something to alleviate their situation.
Sister Lucille Vio spent 25 years working with the sick and the destitute in Pakistan.
I never asked for it, so you can see it was God who prepared the path for me. And in those days, there was a lot of talks about the lepers. And I was asking God, please take me to the lepers. Take me to the lepers. I want to give my life for them. And a thought always guided me. Whatever you do to others, you do unto me, said Jesus.
Even in retirement, these women live to serve the poor.
Denise?
Oh,
bonjour.
75-year-old Sister Denise Paquette, who has driven jeeps in the jungle and lived on nothing but bread and cheese for days, sits in a room unlike any of the others here. It looks like a miniature recycling center filled with stacks of used envelopes, old pens, broken toys, stubby pencils, and neat stacks of empty juice boxes.
I've got old Christmas cards in that, which I recycle. I have things that have been used. I have
this. The reason Sister Denise is collecting these cast-off objects? She repairs the toys, she refills the used ballpoint pens, she reclaims still usable paper, and sends it all to a school she taught in Malaysia.
When I was in Malaysia for the children, I used to go to the airport to get the packing. When they open the packages that they receive at the custom, there's all kinds of stuff to pack the boxes, and the foam, like. And I used to collect all these foam to have some things for the children to do handwork.
But Sisters Denise, Lucille, Florence, and Sister Kathleen know it will take more than their small projects and their personal sacrifice to make a real difference. They believe it will take all of us. Again, Sister Kathleen.
Those who have more has got to live with simplicity so that the excess of wealth they have can be shared with those who have nothing.
For those who think helping the world's poor too mighty a task, these Franciscan sisters point to the words of their founder, St. Francis. Start by doing what's necessary. Then, do what's possible. And suddenly, you're doing the impossible. For the World Vision Report, I'm Judith Ritter in Montreal, Canada.
Aid to Africa doesn't work. It fuels corruption and creates dependence. So says economist Dambisa Moyo. Does she have a point? You decide. That's next on the World Vision Report. This is the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Waymire. Before President Obama headed to Ghana, he stopped in Italy for the G8 summit. That's the meeting of leaders of industrialized nations. G8 members promised to honor their commitments to double aid to Africa by the year 2010. But Dambisa Moyo doesn't think that's a good idea. Moyo is an economist whose new book is causing quite a buzz. It's called Dead Aid: Why Aid Is Not Working and How There's a Better Way for Africa. Dambisa Moyo is a former consultant to the World Bank. She was born and raised in Zambia and educated at Oxford and Harvard. The thesis of her book, that aid is not the answer to Africa's problems, has renewed an old debate. We'll hear from Dambisa Moyo now. Then we speak to economist John MacArthur from Millennium Promise. He takes the opposite point of view. We hope you'll stay with us for this in-depth conversation. First, Dambisa Moyo, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
In your new book, you have a strong argument against foreign aid to Africa. How do you believe that aid has hurt African countries?
There are a whole host of reasons why it is that aid is making things worse across the developing world, and in particular in Africa. The most obvious one is things like corruption, the fact that it fuels corruption and that having large amounts of money coming into the African continent without any recourse for bad behavior means that very often governments take the money and divert it towards their own personal use. But even if you discount the corruption angle, there are a long list of other reasons why aid doesn't work. Things like it creates inflation, it leaves African countries with an inordinate debt burden, but also, particularly most importantly, I would say, it disenfranchises Africans because African governments spend much more time courting and catering the donors rather than trying to build the tax base on the ground.
Can you point specifically to any countries in Africa where aid has poured in great amounts and done nothing to help?
Look at the continent as a whole. The continent has received over $1 trillion in the past 60 years. There is nothing to show for it. Poverty levels are worse. Growth has been on the decline. Paul Collier would call it, the continent is shearing off from the rest of the world. There is no evidence, in fact, anywhere on earth that dumping billions of dollars of aid, as has been the case across the African continent, actually delivers anything. No country on earth has actually achieved long-term economic growth and reduced poverty by relying on aid. We know this to be a fact, and yet we continue to push a model that has no evidence of working anywhere on earth.
But some people have pointed to India and Korea, where aid certainly helped get them on their own financial feet.
Yes, but I think that let's not forget that those type of interventions in places like the Marshall Plan or India, the Green Revolution in South Korea, those interventions were short, sharp interventions and finite. They were not the open-ended commitments that pervade Africa today, where governments in Africa actually view aid monies as permanent income. And that is fundamentally the problem. Until we get to the point where African governments view it as temporary, which is my policy recommendation, that we should actually think about having a transparent phase-out period of the aid model, because only then will we start to see African governments look to find other ways of financing economic development. It's no surprise that the places that you've just mentioned, places like South Korea, have actually adopted the models of trade and foreign direct investment and the capital markets in lieu of aid. And that's why they've become the economic successes that they have been.
So you've actually proposed something pretty dramatic, and that is ending all aid within a five-year period. Do you worry at all that in the short term that might backfire and have deadly results for people in Africa who are now dependent on aid?
Well, I think that to focus on the 5 years is to miss the broader point. The 5 years in the book was simply an example of the manner in which an exit strategy could be applied. Obviously, countries are very different. You could never come up with a five-year blanket strategy for all African countries. I mean, my own country, Zambia, is very different from a failed state such as Somalia. So you can't have the same approach to aid exits for both countries. The more fundamental point that's critical, I think that and should not be missed, is that we all believe, and I believe we all should believe, that Africa cannot rely on aid forever. And so we should be able to have a discussion about when Africa can wean itself off of aid and how it should go about actually implementing that strategy. And it shouldn't be controversial at all. Western countries and the most successful emerging markets do not rely on aid. So why should we not aspire for that for Africa as well?
How will withdrawing aid actually help Africa get on its own feet?
Well, we've actually started to see a number of countries vote with their feet, so to speak. I mean, places like South Africa and Botswana have deliberately, from their very inception, have deliberately not relied on aid to the extent that many other African countries have. But also more recently, we're seeing countries like Ghana, for example, and Gabon actually go to the international capital markets to basically source other sources of capital to finance economic development. So we are actually seeing some positive movement in the direction away from aid and towards other ways, better ways of financing economic development.
You've just noted several countries that seem to be doing what you're suggesting, but critics would say there are many other countries that aren't even close to being able to do that. And they'd call your ideas short-sighted, maybe even dangerous, because in some countries, if we withdraw aid, they would say there's no way they have the resources to tackle the kind of poverty that these countries are facing.
Well, I mean, I think it's a great tragedy that we as a global community have allowed a situation such as what you've just described to emerge. It's been 60 years, and there are many countries in Africa that are now fundamentally worse in terms of poverty and growth than they were 40 years ago. And we as a global community need to be held responsible for the fact that we know what actually works, things like trade, foreign direct investment, job creation through the capital markets are the ways in in which other countries such as China have managed to move millions of people out of poverty. And yet we continue to push an aid model that has not delivered. It's making things worse and not better. And so I strongly believe that my critics are the ones who are being incredibly myopic and perhaps even disingenuous to the extent that they actually have almost no belief in the African continent and the fact that Africa can emerge from this situation.
Your theory is that without the handouts from the rest of the world, African leaders would be motivated by the popular vote of the people to do more for their country. And while theoretically that would work in a healthy democracy, many countries in Africa are ruled by corrupt leaders who really don't care about the popular vote. Take Zimbabwe, for example, which is democratic in theory, but hardly doing the best by its people. Can you really impose our model of democracy on some of these African countries which call themselves democratic and yet whose leaders are so far removed from the people?
Well, I think that's a very good point. And Western media and Western society have been so obsessed with the notion of democracy in its purest sense, i.e. people going to a ballot box and putting in a ballot to vote for leaders, that we've actually missed the bigger, more important point. I actually, in the book, have argued that democracy is not a prerequisite for economic development. And frankly, we will not get the type of liberal democracies and most efficient democracies that we see across the world until such a time as Africans across the continent are able to hold their governments accountable. And we need to first ensure that we have a critical mass of a middle class on the continent, which can then have vested interest in seeing their economies grow and then hold the governments accountable. I also talk a lot about this idea of the reverse Boston Tea Party, that ultimately we will not get representation without taxation. So first, we need to have a tax base that African governments are responsible to, and then we'll get the democracy and institutions that we so desperately seek.
Now, Dambisa, I was actually at the G8 summit in Scotland several years ago, where the major leaders of the industrialized nations were talking about aid to Africa, and it was actually contingent and tied to accountability on the part of the leaders. So when foreign aid is given, it's often tied to the kind of accountability you're talking about. Why would you be against that kind of aid?
Because it works in theory and it does not work in practice. So, for example, you gave the example of Zimbabwe. Well, in 2006, the American government and the British government gave Zimbabwe over $300 million, knowing fully well that this is a government that has questionable interests and certainly is, we would all argue, is perhaps not doing the best for its people. And the problem is with the aid system is that Western governments are incentivized to give aid money. So what do I mean by that? If tomorrow President Obama or Prime Minister Gordon Brown stood up and said, we're going to cut back on aid, the liberal consensus in the United Kingdom or the United States would be up in arms and upset about that and could then hold their governments hostage by not voting for them. So it actually what happens is that these institutions and these Western governments are incentivized to continue to give aid money, even though they know that African governments, in the worst case scenario, steal the money. And even in the best case scenario, it just creates this dependency and allows African governments to abdicate their responsibilities of providing public goods such as education, healthcare, infrastructure, and security, which, by the way, across the continent are largely provided now by donors.
You mentioned the liberal constituency being outraged if foreign aid is cut back. I would think you're getting quite a lot of pushback to your ideas, even though you are an African woman and Zambian, which gives you quite a lot of credibility. What kind of reaction are you getting from the proponents of aid in this country?
Well, I would say, unsurprisingly, people who have vested interest in seeing a perpetuation of this system are upset. So by that, I mean a lot of the fringe NGO groups have been incredibly unfair and deliberately misquoting what it is that I'm saying. I fundamentally believe that we are all on the same side, and I hope we are, in the hope that Africa can and will one day become an equal partner on the global stage and will not need to rely on aid, very much in the manner that Western countries and developed nations don't rely on aid. However, the NGO community is so obsessed with keeping the status quo going, they are not even held to account by anybody. Paul Collier, who was my PhD supervisor, always says that the NGO community is basically government without accountability. And that's exactly what they are. They're running around with money and with mandates that they've imposed on themselves, but nobody holds them accountable for the fact that they are not delivering on what they're supposed to deliver on. And they're taking this money and basically lining their own pockets. And that is fundamentally a problem.
First of all, I want to make sure our listeners understand NGO represents non-governmental organizations like aid groups. Are you saying that aid groups are taking the money and lining the pockets, or the groups on the ground in Africa?
No, I mean, NGOs, I'll give you an example of India in 2004. They expelled pretty much all the NGOs. I think only save four of them were allowed to stay. And that's largely because they do block a lot of the time of policymakers when African and Indian and other policymakers are supposed to be doing focused on delivering growth and reducing poverty. These NGOs come in from abroad and they actually waste a lot of their time pushing their own mandates and are not accountable to anybody. They have no accountability, not to the Africans on the ground, and certainly not to the donor communities that gives them the money in the first place.
I mean, that's a pretty strong attack on the work of NGOs. And I look at the last 10 years of foreign aid. And during that time, NGOs have given 29 million children in Africa an education. 56 million bed nets for malaria have been distributed. And at least 18 African countries have grown by over 5% a year, all with the help of significant aid. So how can you discount all of this?
Well, first of all, the fact that we've seen growth in Africa in the past 10 years is absolutely to do with the commodity boom and foreign direct investment from places like China. It has absolutely nothing to do with aid. And for them to try and take credit for that is completely laughable. The progress that we've seen in Africa recently is in spite of aid, not because of it. With respect to your points about malaria and HIV and so on, I'm not saying that there is no scope for an NGO role. I myself sit on a number of charity boards that focus on providing HIV drugs and also on education. But I don't delude myself in the sense that those types of interventions are band-aid solutions. They are not long-term solutions that are going to deliver Africa to a path of growth and reduce poverty. We need to understand what those interventions do. Let us also remember that ultimately providing antiretroviral drugs, HIV drugs, and providing education is the responsibility of African governments. It's not the responsibility of an army of NGOs who, frankly, we won't know if they're going to be around in 10 years or 20 years. And we have to ask the hard question, what are African governments doing with the money and the resources that they're saving by having these NGO communities providing these goods? But yes, there is some scope for what they're doing, but let's not overstate it, because at the end of the day, these are the responsibilities of the African governments.
And, you know, when Americans think of African aid, they often see Bono or Angelina Jolie or some of these major Hollywood celebrities who are encouraging Americans to give more aid to Africa. And you've actually been called the anti-Bono, because you've said that the Hollywood celebrity push for help to Africa hasn't been very helpful. Why do you think that?
Well, first of all, I think the celebrities are a red herring. I mean, who really cares about what the celebrities think? I mean, as Africans, we care about the future of our children and we want the message to be taken seriously. Specifically to the point of the celebrities, I mean, their whole message is couched in negativity. They thrive on the negative aspects of Africa, and there are many positive things that they just choose not to focus on. So their whole message is basically based on what I call the four horsemen of Africa's apocalypse in the book. So things like war, disease, poverty, and corruption is basically their message. And, you know, that doesn't help us as Africans raise a new cohort of smart young Africans who are going to contribute as engineers or doctors or artists. It basically creates and perpetuates a state of negativity. And then beyond that, the celebrity culture is essentially an artifact of the aid system. It's got to the point that African governments cannot be bothered to, by and large, not all of them, but many of them cannot be bothered to articulate a view about the long-term prospects of Africa and how they're going to alleviate poverty. And that has created a vacuum and essentially allowed allowed anybody to come in. And in this particular case, it's allowed celebrities to opine about what they think should happen in Africa. And ultimately, their views are wrong. It's kind of tantamount or equal to having President Obama and his administration say nothing about the capital markets or what's happening in the housing crisis, and basically having Madonna or somebody start to opine about what should be done about subprime. I mean, it's completely ridiculous, and Americans wouldn't stand for it, and I think Africans shouldn't either.
This isn't just economic theory for you. You grew up in Zambia in an era of what you call the yes, we can period of Africa, kind of post-independence. Your parents were among the first Black graduates from the University of Zambia. And so there was a lot of hope and expectation then. Has that changed?
It absolutely has. It fundamentally has as well, which is a great tragedy. To go from a continent of a lot of hope, home to Nobel laureates and people who were meaningfully trying to change our continent, to one where we are poorer than we were economically, where we've got much more disease and less prospects and hope for our future generations. It's a great tragedy to see this. We are still fundamentally on the wrong path. We are not seeing the meaningful steps that the international community should be taking to actually mean that Africa has a real chance for a proper future.
What do you think are the top three solutions for the continent of Africa in terms of weaning itself from aid and pulling itself out of poverty?
Basically, it's the solutions that other rapidly emerging countries have relied on, places like China and India and South Africa and Botswana. And it's also the solutions that places like the United States and other developed countries have relied on. And this is a combination of things like trade in a meaningful way. I actually recommend in the book that African countries should stop spending their time and resources fighting against the programs that lock African goods out of Western markets and focus on places like China and India that desperately need food security and they need African produce. Second thing is things like foreign direct investment. This is something where there's a lot of scope for investment from abroad and also from home in Africa. However, the African governments, if you look around the continent, it can take up to 2 years in some countries to get a business license. I mean, this is not a formula for encouraging foreign direct investment and job creation. And so there are ways to actually finance development if you encourage foreign direct investment. And then, of course, there are things like the capital markets, the bond markets, where African governments could and should be going to issue bonds in the market and raise money in a more transparent and accountable way than just taking aid, where you actually have no transparency and ultimately you can just fuel corruption.
Dambisa Moyo, author of Dead Aid, Why Aid is Not Working and How There's a Better Way for Africa. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me on your show.
Many in the aid community and elsewhere disagree with Dambisa Moyo. We'll hear the other side of the argument after a short break. Stay with us for the rest of the World Vision Report. La la no kinchi la la. Welcome back to the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Waymire. Before the break, we heard from Dambisa Moyo. She's the author of the book Dead Aid, in which she contends that aid hurts Africa rather than helps it. Her views are controversial, especially among those in the aid community who are working feverishly to meet the Millennium Development Goals. Those are the 8 targets agreed to by nearly 200 countries and all the major development organizations. They include cutting extreme poverty in Africa in half, halting the spread of HIV/AIDS, and reducing infant mortality, all with the help of Western aid, and all by the year 2015. It's an ambitious goal that's been derailed a bit by the recent economic downturn, but many are still committed to it. One of them is John MacArthur, head of Millennium Promise. Welcome to the World Vision Report, John.
Thanks for having me.
John, as you've just heard, Dambisa Moyo makes a pretty strong case for the argument that aid is not helping Africa, and she says it's actually hurting it, and you've disagreed. What's wrong with her anti-aid model?
If we look at the broader case that she's making, I think it's got 3 basic parts. The first is she claims that Africa has become poor, much poorer, in the past few decades. The second is that she said that there has been aid to Africa over that period. And then the third is that she says, therefore, we should do something different. So if we look first at what's actually happened in Africa over the past few decades, we see it's, in fact, outright false that Africa is much poorer than it was a few decades ago. Dambisa said in different interviews that 10% of Africans were living in poverty in the 70s, and now it's 70%. That's actually just wrong, and the official statistics are quite clear. The level of extreme poverty has actually been quite consistent, measured by income, over the past few decades, and it's been about 70% living on less than $2 a day for as long as the official data go back to roughly 1981, and it's pretty consistent before then. But also we see that even in this past decade, the official statistics show that the percentage of Africans living in extreme poverty, which is judged by a measure of about $1.25 a day, that's the poorest of the poor, has actually come down significantly since 1999 in particular.
But even if we look at, do you think?
Well, I think it's important to even look at the other areas of progress as well. So we've had a tremendous decline in child mortality in the past 30 years. We've had tremendous advances in literacy and in enrollment. We have 35 more million children in school today than at the turn of the decade. We have 2 million more people on AIDS treatment. And so we've had these actually areas of tremendous success in some countries like Mozambique, like Malawi, and many others, actually growing very fast in the lead up in particular to the global economic crisis.
I would imagine her response to that would be that yes, there has been some growth, but that's had to do with the commodity boom and direct capital investment from Africa. It's actually happened in spite of aid, not because of it.
In terms of how much progress there's been, there's, of course, a whole set of statistical questions to answer about how we attribute the different causes of progress. But where we look at the causes, especially of progress in health and education, we see that there's tremendous progress that's unambiguously linked to global partnership with external support for local programs in things like AIDS control, primary education, malaria control, public-private partnerships often, and really dramatic breakthroughs. Mm-hmm. Then, if we look at economic growth, which is, you know, a second question separate from basic measures of progress in health and education, we see that there are several areas where, for example, as the AIDS pandemic has been curbed in its utter devastation, still extraordinarily devastating unto itself, but curbed. We see the productive workforces are, you know, able to work with greater productivity. We see that people are literally able to stay alive. And we see many areas of basic progress. Now, there are several countries like Mozambique, which have had tremendous progress, a doubling of its gross national product per capita, a doubling of its economy in the past 15 years or so, alongside tremendous amounts of aid. We saw Uganda coming out of its civil conflicts had similar relationships. And it's ironic, in fact, Dambisa's professor Paul Collier did a very detailed study on the progress in Uganda backed by foreign aid. And we see that certainly there are many areas where aid has not been adequately successful, and all of us should agree on that. But there are clear lessons where aid has been very successful. And getting from the stage of progress in the basic aspects of health, education, and so forth that are critical ingredients to broader economic growth need to feed in the extra pieces that are still needed in areas like infrastructure, agricultural productivity. We have to remember roughly two-thirds of Africans are farmers. Their business is growing food. And so there are critical areas that where more progress is needed, more support is needed. And an example would be Malawi, where the government just in the past 3 years, one of the poorest countries on the planet, has doubled its food production with basic support for fertilizer and seeds for literally 2 million households backed by foreign aid. And remarkably, even during the economic crisis of 2008, the Wall Street Journal recently reported 9% economic growth because the farmers are doing better.
Okay. I want to break this down a little bit and get specific.
Sure.
One of Dambisa Moyo's strongest arguments, and many Americans who read newspapers and listen to stories about this tend to think it's true, and that is that corruption is a major problem among African government leaders, and that aid seems to actually fuel that corruption because large amounts of money are going to African leaders who end up pocketing it or diverting it elsewhere. I mean, the New York Times even recently did an article saying that the fight against corruption just isn't working very well in Africa. What do you say to this?
Well, I think corruption is always a global issue and a global concern, and we look at ourselves in the mirror in the rich countries. We saw the governor of Illinois was indicted for allegations of, you know, trying to sell a Senate seat. And we have, you know, billions of dollars of unattributed earmarks and congressional budgets. And
we have a system of checks and balances where there's much more accountability. Yes, there's corruption. But in Africa, isn't there an argument that there isn't enough accountability? And that's one of the reasons that the money isn't going to the right places.
We also have, I think, systems where there's checks and balances in the aid system, many of which need to be better, many of which are quite strong. And I think we see that aid can't be blamed for all corruption for certain, just like there are many countries that don't get much aid that have tremendous problems with corruption in the poor environments of the world. And there are many rich countries that have real problems with the same. The Global Fund to Fight AIDS, TB, and Malaria has been a major development in the global system in the past decade, where they support national programs that are subject to peer review and international technical review. And there have been several instances where corruption has been identified at the country level, and those programs have been stopped and then restarted once there's been a cleanup. And I think the basic story is that in places where aid has been used not to finance armies of American aid workers or anything like that, but to finance local programs and local tools and local technologies like the bed nets, like the fertilizer, like the AIDS treatment, and been linked to clear, measurable outcomes, that's where we've seen the great breakthroughs.
Those examples you just gave sound very good, but what percentage of aid is tied to that kind of local accountability?
Certainly more is needed, for sure. And I think we have to think about what's the scale of aid. So I know Dambisa likes to use a big number of $1 trillion being used but over the past 50 years. But what does that actually mean? I mean, we're spending $2 trillion just within a year on our own local stimulus program. If you look at what the actual amount of aid is, it's been about $35 per African per year over the past few decades. And the reality is that the rich countries are $35 billion behind on what they promised in 2005 to make available by next year, 2010. No one works harder than my colleagues, or I try to work to make sure that things are linked to real outcomes. And we all know stories of things that have gone poorly, and there's no question about that, and those things should be discontinued. But to throw some blanket diagnosis and to, you know, call it laughable to have 2 million people on AIDS treatment or 35 million kids in school or, 170 million bed nets distributed, to call that laughable off $35 per person of total aid support seems to me a deep misunderstanding, because in a sense, we're putting a very small amount of money into this from all parts of the world. That's $35 from every country around the rich world. And it's a very small amount of money in any real macroeconomic sense. And of course, there's a share of it which hasn't been working well enough. And that's why we work to really advocate and advance these mechanisms of transparency and auditable results that have been really the key ingredients to larger scale success.
This debate is so controversial and so complicated, but it's a significant debate. We give, maybe it's not a trillion, as Dambisa says, but close to $1 trillion in aid to Africa. You say $35. The donor countries, which would be mostly Western countries in the United States.
Right. Over 50, 60 years, yeah.
Right. And yet, anytime you hear or read about Africa, there are terrible problems still there. So the question has to be, why isn't this amount of aid appearing to make a big difference?
Well, I actually, you know, with all due respect, Peggy, I think the way that that question is framed isn't quite right, because, you know, we've been talking about all the progress, you know, 30% reduction in child mortality, 170 million bed nets distributed, major, major breakthroughs for $35 per person. And right now, you know, the total aid to Africa this year is, you know, on the order of $35 billion for everything. So $1 trillion is a bit of a scary number. It strikes me as a bit of a marketing tactic, frankly, because it's such a big number. But in any sense of real economy, it's very modest. And the flip side is that there have been major successes. Mm-hmm. We have to understand that. The successes are major, especially in the past decade. We're not looking at foreign aid to prop up Cold War friends or anything like that. That was really much, you know, a significant amount of the use in previous decades. in the 2000s in particular, we've seen tremendous, tremendous breakthroughs. We're putting $35 in per person for humanitarian aid in the emergencies, for food supply, shipping, for AIDS control, for malaria control, for education, for the nurses, for a little bit of fertilizer in a few places. How much do we expect to be able to pay for? And in a sense, it's remarkable how much success we're getting off such a small amount of resources in any real sense of measuring dollars.
Then let me ask you, and this question might seem a little ruthless, but I know some are asking it, and that is, why is it the responsibility of the United States and other Western nations to be the ones to help pull Africa out of this? Doesn't this make Africa continually dependent on aid? Why should we be the ones to solve these problems for them?
Well, I think it's important to say that no one's looking for a permanent state of affairs here. Far from it. And I was glad to see Dambisa very clearly back away from her call to end aid within 5 years in her discussion with you. I think she's, adopting a position that's quite similar to what those of us who have been, advocating for a fulfillment of commitments advocate, which is, really following through on the basic commitments so that the economies can get on their feet to the basic steps of economic growth and get on this the path of self-sustaining economic development. It's crazy, in my view, and many others, to try and set an artificial timeline, but we need to think through, and I think agriculture, because it's the centerpiece of the economies in rural farm economies where the majority of people are farmers, agriculture is probably the one big, big missing piece in Africa. And so we have to think through how can these places get on the path to graduating from aid, just like so many other countries, especially in Asia, have done. So that's the first piece. We're not talking about aid for all time. We're talking about fulfillment of commitment so that countries can graduate in a reasonable amount of time. But then the second piece is to answer your question directly on why. Well, I think one of the things that we have seen in countless forms in the past few years is how interconnected our planet is, ranging from, H1N1 virus coming out of places that have emergent diseases, perhaps, that quickly go around the world. We see that everywhere is connected, whether it's security, whether it's health, whether it's, promoting shared prosperity through trade. Whether we like it or not, and in fact, whether we realize it or not, we are now living in a shared community of the global planet and the global society. And we need to really be thinking through not just weather, because weather isn't the case anymore. It's how we work on investing in global stability, in ensuring a shared prosperity around the world, and again, making sure that joint accountability is the framework for our global partnerships. It's not about handouts, far from it. It's about accountability and partnership strategies. And we need to make sure that, supporting a person dying of AIDS to get basic access to treatment isn't, looking down on that person. Quite the opposite. It's looking up to that person for their dignity, for their respect, for their opportunity to have a job, to take care of their families, to do the basic things that they couldn't afford to do in the absence of access to AIDS treatment. And that's really how I think we need to think about having mutual respect and empathy for the aspirations of communities and families around the world.
John MacArthur, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much.
John MacArthur is head of Millennium Promise. He spoke to us from New York. People are able to contribute to Africa by writing checks. Others volunteer time. Still others make it their life work. A few years ago, Dave Snyder was working in Ghana for Catholic Relief Services. That's when he met David Mbamba. Mbamba is part of a large family, and his parents depend on him to contribute to the family income. In this aid worker diary, Dave Snyder explains why that responsibility can mean unfulfilled dreams.
David Mbamba is a bartender in the dusty town of Dimongo in northern Ghana. Every evening he serves drinks to tired travelers at the small guest house where he works, not far from a large national park. David is quiet and friendly, with a smoky baritone voice and the patient look of a skillful listener. On the night I stayed at the guest house, I was his only patron. Beneath a full moon, clouded by dusty winds, we shared the details of our lives. David was the third of seven siblings. His family put all of their resources into educating his eldest brother, but after his brother graduated from college, he died suddenly, and with him went the money he was sending home. Now the whole family works to keep his second eldest brother in school, so for David, the chance for an education is not likely to come. The 24-year-old bears the weight of his circumstances with quiet dignity. He works 7 days a week and saves, in the best months, $10 from his wages. He saves nothing, he says, if there is trouble. His life now is full of ifs, which he offers not as complaint, but only as fact. If he had $300, he could go to school for 2 years to learn computers. If he had $100 more, he could buy a used computer to practice. Then he could get a job, he says, and get married. $400 to change his life. I sit quietly in the moonlight, turning that number over in my head, embarrassed suddenly at my $7 meal and my $2 beer, almost his monthly savings. But, he adds quietly, glancing off towards the lone light of the nearby kitchen, you must cut your coat to fit your cloth. We talked for a while more about crops and animals and the one trip David took to Accra, the capital, as a schoolboy. When I finished my beer, we shook hands, and I thanked him for talking with me. I set off towards the guest house, my steps swallowed in the soft red sand, and left David alone wiping plastic tables with a damp rag, cutting his coat, night by night, to fit his cloth.
David Snyder is a writer and photographer based in Baltimore. And that's it for this week. You can see photos to go with all our stories on our website, worldvisionreport.org. Our show is produced by Beverly Abel. Lita Hartman is the assignment editor. Christina Darden, Cynthia Graber, and Sue Shepard produce our interviews. Our interactive editor is Larry Short, and I'm Peggy Wehmeyer.
Support for this program comes from World Vision, building a better world for children. The views expressed on this show are not necessarily those of the organization.